Welcome to the archives of The Laura Lee Show, conversation for exploration. These are timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. While you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect our own or those of the Cuimongue Institute. That's why we call it conversation for exploration. Hello there, I'm Laura Lee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. We're going to talk about shaman and shamanism, and I think one of the best guys in our Western culture to talk with is Mark Plotkin. He's been spending, over the years, an extended amount of time per visit with the shamans of the Amazon rainforest. He's an ethnobotanist, and that means a botanist specializing in the plant use of ethnic and indigenous cultures. And for many decades, Mark has been spending lots of times with shamans to learn their use of herbs, but also along the way, because we spoke last time with Mark about some of those herbs. He's looking for the next wonder drug among all those herbs in the rainforest before they disappear and the shamans with them. Mark has a lot of stories, a lot of observations, and a lot of thoughts about the philosophy, the ways, the customs, the beliefs, the practices, and the abilities, the special abilities of the medicine men or the shamans that he's met and spent a lot of time with. And he has become inside in their culture in ways that most of us are not privy to. So Mark has some very special knowledge to share with us. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Laura. It's good to be back.
Good to be back. Your book, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, is a fascinating read, by the way, so I want to congratulate you. I understand it's in its seventh printing.
That's correct.
You know, our culture is fascinated by shamans these days, and I think of it this way, that as we begin to acknowledge and legitimize the non-physical realms, other dimensions, the quantum world, however you want to phrase it, we start to make connections old to new, and we realize that the shamans have long been emissaries to that realm. They know this realm, they can tell us something about it, they can give us a roadmap, a set of directions, and reconnect us with a long and rich heritage. What do you attribute our current fascination to?
Well, I think that as successful as our culture is, as successful as our science is, as successful as our medicine is, we all realize that there are shortcomings. We're hitting a brick wall in a lot of ways. And the shaman or shaman represents somebody, a mysterious figure out there that can help us get over that wall or around that wall or even through it. And there's a yearning in our culture for a new philosophy, a new healing, and I think the shaman embodies that.
And new philosophy and new healing, could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, you know, friends who went into medical school, when I went into ethnobotany, are now calling me up and saying, hey, they discovered this new thing called visualization or massage therapy or aromatherapy. And my mentors, the shamans, have been practicing this for 50,000 years. So the fact of the matter is, it's sort of a back-to-the-future approach to healing that we're learning from these people who have long been derided by other members of our culture as primitive or backwards.
I think it's important for us to realize that our civilization has gone on for 50,000 years and not the 2,000 years of Christianity. We tend to think it kind of begins with Christianity here in the Western world, but we have a very, very long history.
Well, it's true, and you can even look at it in more cynical terms, which is that Western medicine, as we practice, is only really about 200 years old, and these other methods of healing, and I'm not just talking about shamanistic medicine, I'm talking about Ayurvedic medicine, I'm talking about acupuncture, is many, many thousands of years older, as you point out.
So many cultures. You point out Ayurvedic, which is from India, but so many cultures have a shamanistic element to them. Siberia, Tibet, our Native Americans, both North and South, Pacific Islands, Aboriginal, Africa, of course, Celtic, and the goddess culture, which was so widespread throughout Europe. Have you looked into some of these other indigenous cultures, what's left of them or their remnants, to see what they share with the shamans that you met in the Amazon rainforest, basic principles, practices, philosophy?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because when I was writing my book, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, I did go into the literature on this, and you go back and read the accounts of the Siberian shamans who were first contacted really at the turn of the century, and their chants are very, very, very similar to some of the shamanistic chants in the Amazon, like the Yanomamo, the so-called fierce people that I work with on the Brazil-Venezuela border. It's very, very, very similar, which really, in this case, particular, shows a common heritage.
Oh, and what do you attribute to? Do you think there was contact between those?
Well, there's no question that the Amerindian peoples in this hemisphere came across the Bering Strait 50,000 years ago, so this is a common cultural heritage. This is kind of an interesting argument I have with some friends of mine who say, well, you know, my ancestors came from Africa, and I say, well, yeah, mine did too. I mean, we all have a common ancestry. Ours just left Africa a lot earlier. So the point here is that there really is a commonality in the human experience, in the human religion, in the human belief system, and it's only in the last couple of hundreds of years, and maybe thousands of years, that these cultures have begun to split apart and take on their separate identities.
One thing that I understand about shamanistic techniques for healing is that it takes into account our psychology. And in a sense, is it true that they engage the person themselves to, or the deep psychology to also clear? I understand there's very little mental illness among these tribes as well.
Well, my old mentor, Professor Schultes at Harvard, would say that the advantage the shaman and in practicing shamanistic medicine have over our system is that the doctors take the medicine rather than the patients. That is, the doctors, the shamans, the medicine men and medicine women take the hallucinogenic plants in order to diagnose their difficult cases. But the fact of the matter is that there are people out there who say that ethnobotanists like myself who are searching for new medicinal plants are really missing the boat, in that the real genius of shamanistic medicine isn't treating these psychiatric disorders, that you do see very little mental illness in these areas where you have these shamans practicing their sacred craft. Now, I personally believe that's mostly due to the fact that they don't suffer from the crowded conditions that we do in this country, that they don't suffer from the stress conditions that we do in this country, but there's no question that they are expert in treating some psychiatric disorders, and it is certainly true that you don't see people with all sorts of manifestations of mental illness like you do in every major city in this country.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, Mark, if you will detail, have you seen some healings up close? Were you able to observe some? Can you tell us from start to finish what some of these practices entail and your thoughts on hallucinogens? And we'll take some calls from our audience. For Mark Plotkin, ethnobotanist. We'll be right back. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, we are back. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Thanks for tuning in. Mark Plotkin joins us, ethnobotanist. You know, Mark, I was just thinking that for anyone in college or high school who's wondering what an adventuresome, fascinating, and important contribution they can make to the world, ethnobotany might be a field for them. Let's take our first call for you, Mark. That's David calling from Renton, Washington, listening to KVI. Hi, David.
Hello, Laura Lee.
Hi.
I'm one of your frequent listeners here.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Anyway, I wanted to ask Mark some general questions. Myself, as a hobby, I study alternative medicine and herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And I have read some articles about a certain plant that grows down in, like, Ecuador that the natives use. And supposedly, if you're nearsighted, you can take this plant after a while, and it can cure your eyes. Have you heard anything about this plant?
Well, I haven't, but there's about 15,000 species of higher plants in Ecuador, so I can't figure out that one without some kind of a name, even an Indian name. But there's no question that some of the plants that are being used in Ecuador are already making it into markets here in the U.S. In fact, in the Mission District in San Francisco, I've seen Ecuadorian plants for sale.
Is there any stories in South America, like there are in Asia, certain monks that lived a proper life, a good lifestyle, took certain herbal combinations, lived for an astonishing long periods of time?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question in that many of these old medicine men lived to ripe old ages, and they're well into their 80s and 90s, but the average age is only in the 50s, and that has to do with a lot of infant mortality. I haven't heard of any herbs that you eat them and you live to this ripe old age. I think the key phrase there in what you said is that of lifestyle. And I think, again, this is a lesson that we need to bring into Western medicine, that it's preventative medicine. It's not just the magic bullet which Western medicine is obsessed with. You know, you keep smoking, you keep eating crap, and then you just take this magic bullet and you get better. We need to think about living a better life, living a cleaner life, living a more stress-free life, taking the right medicines on an as-needed basis, and that's how you live to a ripe old age.
Thanks. I'm glad more doctors are putting that into their practice and getting the word out to their patients. David, thank you for the call. I want to hear, Mark, about some of the philosophy that these shamans that you know have for the human soul, the human body, health, disease process, mental illness, it must be all part of one paradigm.
Well, you know, the shamans say that disease is caused by evil spirits entering the body, and you tell this to people here in our own society, and most of them say, well, that's nonsense, that's mumbo-jumbo. But to me, that's nothing more than the germ theory in the same model, just a rather a different description. You know, I was out looking for treatments for diabetes on my last expedition, and I went to see one of the paramount shamans of the Northeast Amazon, and he said, nope, you know, don't know the disease, don't have a treatment for it, can't help you cure it, sorry. And then the day before I was leaving, he summoned me to his hut. He said, look, I was taking a nap in my hammock this afternoon, and I had a dream. And in that dream, I saw this plant that you will find if you go 2 hours upriver and then 1 hour into the forest on the eastern bank. Now, I did what I was told. I took the trip 2 hours upriver, 1 hour into the forest, and I found the tree. Now, this shaman has spent his whole life in a wheelchair. So you might say, well, how did he know that? But by the same token, people will say, well, he had a dream. I mean, that's not science. How can you pay attention to that? Well, how did Western science arrive at the structure of the chemical benzene? The scientists couldn't figure it out, went to sleep, had a dream of snakes chasing their tail, and lo and behold, he figured out that it was a benzene ring. So this idea that, you know, they think differently than we do has been overemphasized in the literature, and it's been one of the causes of Western science looking down on shamans and shamanistic practices.
If you knew of all the, if we could put a list together of all the scientific and other inventions and discoveries that have been made through dreams, we'd have quite a long list. It's replete in the literature. This shaman was in a wheelchair. What happened to him? What was his story?
I think he had polio as a very small child. He's quite old now, and when I ask people how long has he been in a wheelchair, they say forever.
I understand that many get chosen for being a shaman and going to shaman training, quote-unquote, because they are special in some way. What's the story? How do people become a shaman? How are they chosen?
Well, in the Northeast Amazon, there's two basic methods. One is that the shaman finds a child who has a propensity for healing or an interest in plants or has some sort of special sign, which I don't particularly understand, and they ask him or her, in Northeast Amazon, really him, to be an apprentice. In some cases, the child can approach the shaman and say, I want a cure, will you take me on as an apprentice? So these are the two methods which they're chosen. But I should point out that these are the traditional methods, because what's happening now with the advent of Western medicine is that the young people don't want to be shamans anymore. They don't see the relevance of it. And this 10,000, thousands of years old tradition is dying out because these kids want to have boomboxes and hula hoops.
And it's very sad. What about hallucinogens? Because they're available in this society and the shamans use them in a very special way for a very special purpose with a lot of discipline, correct? How does this availability of these plant substances and these young children who maybe don't understand, are they abused? What's the story there?
Well, one of the reasons we have so many drug problems in our culture is these drugs are used outside of context. Because for the most part, hallucinogens in these societies are only used ritualistically. They're used very sparingly for certain occasions, like the harvest of the peach palm, for example. It's not something you come home, you know, after a hot day mowing the lawn and you open a beer. You don't do this with these hallucinogens. They're very serious. Many of these people worship them as the home of the gods, and they only take them for these particular festivals. The only exception to that are the Yanomamo, the so-called fierce people I mentioned earlier. Every Yanomamo roundhouse I've ever been in, they're doing the sacred hallucinogen apena. I felt like I was back in my dormitory in my college days.
Could you tell us a story about this? Did you try them yourself?
Well, I went into the roundhouse and saw them taking the snuff and tried to be unobtrusive, but obviously was fascinated as an ethnobotanist. This is what we go there to seek. A hallucinogenic snuff is one of our holy grails. So I approached these fellows doing the snuff, and the shaman looked at me and sort of beckoned me over and took the bamboo tube, filled it with snuff, and pointed it in my direction. Well, I tried to explain to him that I was there to study it, that I was interested in sampling it, but not right now. I'd just gotten there, but he didn't speak any Spanish or Portuguese. So he just filled the darn thing up and pointed it at me. And being an ethnobotanist and knowing something of a local protocol, I took the other end of the snuff tube and inserted it in my right nostril.
What happened?
Well, he exhaled very sharply, and then stuck it in my left nostril and did the same thing, and then stuck it in my right nostril and did the same thing, and then stuck it back in my left nostril and did the same thing. And I was setting out for parts unknown at that point in time.
Do you remember what happens? I mean, are they different than, is each hallucinogen
different in terms of the kind of access it gives you to other realms? Or does it depend how is it used?
Well, this is a very visual and auditory hallucinogen. There's a very detailed account of this in my book, which talks about the fact that, you know, when you take it, you start to see the little men in the trees that they call the Hekura, which are tutelary spirits that live in the trees that come down and lodge in your chest if you're a shaman and teach you how to cure.
Did that happen to you?
Well, I could see the little people, and I could hear the chants they were singing, but I'm not a shaman, so it didn't help me cure. I'm merely a shaman's apprentice.
How do you understand it in your own terms, little people?
Well, Lurley, that's an excellent question, because I can't explain it. And I think it's a mistake in some cases to try and explain it, because you just can't understand everything. These people have a different reality. And I think our best attitude is to accept that rather than to say it's not our reality, so it can't be true, it can't happen, they're making it up, it's nonsense, it's witchcraft, it's mumbo-jumbo. And in writing my work, I often have trouble, how do you deal with these types of issues? And the way that I deal with it is I write it as I see it, I call it as I see them, and let the reader judge for themselves.
I think the same is true of the near-death experience. When people try to explain it perfectly and only in scientific terms, it falls short. Something science can't explain, and these are very real experiences, and perhaps we do just go through a doorway and into another dimension where the rules are different.
I believe that we do, and you know, everybody has a different reality. You see the world through different eyes than I do, and there is a common ground, there's a common language that you can explain just so much, and then it ends. And I feel that sometimes explanation just doesn't suffice. You just got to explain it like you saw it and let people take it or leave it.
What is your opinion of the war on drugs as practiced here in America? There was Catherine Cryer hosted a whole episode on television recently where she was comparing our policy for drugs to that of Holland and countries where they're cooperating with people more and saying, let's have managed use so people don't go on the streets and rob and commit crimes for this stuff.
Well, it's interesting you ask this because I just came back from Holland, and what you don't see on the streets of Amsterdam or The Hague is the homelessness, is the crime that is rampant in our cities. Now, a lot of this is certainly due to drugs, but not all of it. And I'm an ethnobotanist, means I'm a specialist in medicinal plants. I'm not a specialist on medicinal plant policies.
Right. But you know what? Let's get the rest of your comments and more when we come back with Mark Plotkin and Laura Lee. And we are back. Hi, I'm Laura Lee. Mark will be with us for the next half hour if you'd like to talk with him about shamanism. Mark is the author, as an ethnobotanist, he's the author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. Mark, your comments, I'll let you finish, on drug policy. You said you're an ethnobotanist, you don't really have any comments on drug policy,
I
think you do.
They're layman's comments. That is, our drug policy in this country is clearly not working. Look at all the problems that result from drug abuse in this country. Most of that comes from the fact that these drugs are taken out of context. In the Andes, coca is a wonder drug and a wonder medicine. When you purify it and turn it into crack cocaine, it's a terribly addictive drug, which is why we have these terrible problems in our cities. So I don't have the answer with what's wrong with the drug problems in our country, but it's clear to me and everybody else out there that the answers that we're trying to implement are not working.
What were you doing in Holland?
My book just came out in Dutch, so I was over there doing a fundraising tour.
Oh, terrific. Also, Ron Siegel, I think, at a university somewhere here on the West Coast, says that the drive to escape is almost like a sixth drive. Hunger, sex, shelter, protect, you know, all that. He says there's also this means to want to step into another realm, and he attributes some of that to drugs. Now, I don't think you need drugs to do that. I think you can meditate, or there's many other means of entering an altered state of consciousness. Certainly, I'm told the Aborigines enter altered states like we walk through doorways on a daily basis. But I'm just wondering, if you take the equivalent of a personality profile that had become a shaman in these cultures that you visited, and you put that person in the machine age and in Western culture in the late 20th century, what did they do? Who are these people, and how did they find means of entering some of those realms or practicing a philosophy that would include that paradigm?
Well, I believe that charismatic figures are charismatic figures no matter what society they inhabit. So I don't think the great shamans with whom I've worked in the last 15 years would turn out to be, quiet, mousy accountants if they were in our culture. They would be charismatic figures, be it politicians or great surgeons or philosophers or what have you. I mean, the mistake that we make in our society, I think, is that we've separated healing from philosophy, from religion. All of these are different figures. In shamanistic cultures, it's all one person. And when you take these people out of their culture, they can't be shamans, but they'll be something else of importance in the culture you place them into, I firmly believe.
And what role do the shamans play in the cultures that you visited? Are they leaders? Are they the statesmen? Do they make policy? Are they as well as healers and doctors?
It's interesting because they're never chiefs, but they are the healer, they are the priest or rabbi, they are the philosopher, they're the keeper of the legends, or even the psychopomp, which is the person who conveys souls to the underworld.
Oh, so they help the funeral rites, in other words.
They do help with the funeral rites.
Could you tell me your opinion of the 20th century shamanism going on in workshops and lectures today that's so widespread?
Well, I think it's absolutely terrific that people are turning to the old ways to some of the answers to our current problems. I think it can be done right, and I think it can be done wrong. I don't think that anybody should be fooled into believing that to be a full-fledged shaman in these shamanistic cultures is 4 to 6 years minimum, and then you pay somebody a couple $100 and you go to a workshop for a weekend and you're a shaman. Now, I do believe you can start to learn shamanistic practices, but I'm not into this rent-a-shaman thing where people say, you know, pay me $900 and I'll turn you into a shaman. This is a very serious discipline. It requires a great deal of study. So I come right down in the middle of this. I don't say that, you know, if you're not an Indian, you can't be a shaman, nor do I say that, you know, send me a check and I'll turn you into a shaman. Just to give you a personal insight into this type of what happens when people try and become shamans in other cultures. A colleague of mine has worked with the Huichol Indians in Mexico for 8 years. During that period of time, 4 outsiders, that is 4 Caucasians, have tried to become shamans. 3 of them have died and 1 of them has gone insane.
It's dangerous territory to travel, in other
Absolutely.
Words, if you don't know
it's
what you're
not
doing.
For the light of heart.
Does that happen to shamans within that culture? Are they very carefully guided in their tutelage so that this does not happen to them?
Well, this is one of the reasons they're able to use these psychotropic drugs without running into problems, because they always have a so-called spirit guide with them, a shaman who knows what they're doing, knows the dosage, knows the potential dangers, and can make sure that these dangers don't crop up.
How do psychotropic drugs work? You must have looked into that as an ethnobotanist.
Well, I have. I mean, they affect centers in the brain that affect the way that we deal with reality, which is what allows you to do all the wonderful things that these drugs are supposed to be able to allow you to do. You know, there's an interesting parallel with the Middle Ages with the so-called witches, where these witches believed they could fly across the night sky. Well, they could fly across the night sky in their minds because they were taking these powerful drugs full of tropane alkaloids that give the sensation of flying. But these are very dangerous drugs, and it's not something you knock back like you knock back a beer, as I mentioned earlier, and think, okay, well, I'll fly across the night sky. Well, you may do so, but you're going to fall off your broomstick and land up on your head.
And maybe never come out of it.
Absolutely.
And end up in a mental hospital.
Absolutely.
There have been other people who have said that many of the mental cases or schizophrenia or people that just lose reality are experiencing something parallel to what a shaman can enter in knowingly and in full consciousness, but these people that become mentally ill just don't know the doorway out again. They can't tell this physical reality from the other realms. Is that?
Well, I think that's to some degree true, but a bit of an oversimplification. That I don't believe that all shamans are psychotics that know the indoor and the outdoor.
Uh-huh.
I believe that there are these sort of psychotic states that some of them enter into, or some of these certainly altered reality states that they enter into with these psychotropic plants. But I do not believe that you know, our mental wards are full of shamans and we just misdiagnose them, and that's why these poor people are locked away.
Oh, the people that had given this as an opinion didn't mean to imply that all cases, they were just saying a few in their
right,
opinion.
Right, but I'm sure you've
again,
heard that.
It's
I mean, there's wonderful movies made about that. The movie King of Hearts, everybody in the insane asylum is really sane and we're all insane, that sort of thing.
David, calling from Seattle.
Hello all. My interest was piqued when you brought up the subject of mind-altering plants. I'm fascinated by the theory that the ancient Peruvians used a hallucinogenic cactus to achieve an out-of-body state that enabled them to produce the Nazca lines, those
right.
enormous earth drawings that can only be interpreted when flying above them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on this or any similar circumstances or stories?
Well, I've been to Nazca, and it's entirely conceivable that they thought up the lines under the influence of the San Pedro cactus, but that's quite a bit removed from where the San Pedro cactus grows. And if you're really interested in that, the best account of it was published in the book Plants of the Gods by Schultes and Hoffman, published by Healing Arts Press in Vermont. And there was a scientific paper on the San Pedro cactus cult by my old colleague Wade Davis in the Botanical Museum leaflets of Harvard University.
Wade Davis wrote The Serpent and the Rainbow.
That's right. He was an old roommate of mine at Harvard.
Oh, how interesting. Are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, I just saw him recently at a Schultes appreciation dinner down in Texas.
Is this the same Schulte that was your professor that you mentioned earlier?
Exactly.
Okay. You run with some interesting people there, Mark. How do the people in the cultures that you visited, the average person who's not a shaman, not a leader, they're just whatever role they play, do they do some form of meditation or religious rites, obviously, and practices? But how much does the shaman's philosophy enter in on a daily basis, I guess is what I'm asking, to the other people in the tribe?
You can draw a pretty clear parallel with our own society, which is the layperson is the layperson, and it is something about religion, but not as much as the priest or the rabbi. And they go to church or practice their rites for these special occasions, be it every Sunday or for the harvest of the peach palm, like I mentioned. And it's the shaman whose duty it is to oversee the religion, oversee the culture, and be able to answer cosmological questions when they come up.
And miracles, have you seen the shamans that you've met perform anything that we would call a miracle?
Yes, I have.
Could you tell us about it? This all has
to do with your conception of miracles, and this all has to do with your conception of magic. You know, one of the reasons that some of these shamanistic medicines don't work outside their shamanistic context is that of magic, and I define magic in the broad sense. You know, when I was born, my mother told me she was worried sick that I'd get polio because this was a terrible plague at the time, and then scientists in the lab came up with a polio vaccine. Well, to me, that's one form of magic, broadly defined. I was just down in the Amazon looking for a new treatment for diabetes. A woman came into my hut dying of diabetes. Now, I'm not a physician, but I'm working with a physician who was able to diagnose this. The shaman took a look at her, went into the jungle, mixed up some plants, gave it to her, and her blood sugar level went from near fatal to near normal in a 12-hour period. Now, to me, that's magic. But what we're doing now is looking at these plants in the lab to find out what the chemical constituents are that lowered this woman's blood sugar with an eye towards possibly bringing it to market to help people with diabetes around the world. Now, maybe it was what we would call the placebo effect. Maybe it was the chanting. Maybe it was the magic smoke. Maybe it was the alkaloids in the plant. That's what we're trying to find out.
And we'll take another break and come right back with Mark Plotkin. We'll be back. I'm Laura Lee. We are back, Laura Lee, here on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Mark Plotkin, ethnobotanist, author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. He spends a lot of time with the shamans of the rainforest of the Amazon. Mark, could you paint us a picture of some of the shamans that you know and love best?
Well, you know, Laura Lee, you look in the popular culture as we experience it, and our first contact with the shaman, the so-called witch doctor, is the Tarzan movie. This was always a figure of ridicule, jumping around in a grass skirt, mumbling all this nonsense, waving rubber snakes around. But in the Amazon, these people have great dignity. They're great healers. They're people of great learning. And working with some of these old fellows, like I've grown up with, the jaguar shaman, the old witch doctor, the Wayanas, the Tementa, the paramount shaman of the tears, it's really a different reality. It's really a different set of beliefs than you learn in the Western classrooms, but these people know a lot that we can learn from them.
Do you ever see a time when Western medicine will fully embrace that wisdom incorporated, or else have two parallel tracks that aren't trying to kill one another?
Well, I believe we're headed in that direction. You know, here in Washington, D.C., we now have the Office of Alternative Medicine, and there's a real story behind that, because Congress asked the National Institute of Health if they wanted to set this thing up, and they said, no, that's not science. We're not interested. We can't learn anything from them. Imagine a government agency turning down free government money. It doesn't happen here much. But Congress responding to the pleas of their listeners who said, look, you know, I went to the doctor and he didn't help me or she hurt me, and I went to this alternative healer and I got better. Congress forced it on them, so this office does exist. However, it's wildly underfunded. It's only a couple of million bucks a year.
That's nothing in Washington, D.C.
exactly,
terms.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, these things are starting to happen, but we need to work together to make sure that this stuff is put more in the mainstream so we can take advantage of it. I've been attacked by people who said, oh, you're trying to set medicine back. You want us to close down the pharmacies and rub leaves in our hair. That's not what I'm advocating at all. All I'm saying is there are other systems of healing out there. There's plants, there's animals that can be used for healing purposes. Let's learn from these shamans because they can help us.
Here in Seattle, my hometown, there is a major hospital, Harborview, which is now about to incorporate a whole division of alternative medicine officially. And so I think it's happening in large and small ways. We have a call from Bill in Lakewood, Florida, listening to WJNO. He wants to know if there are any herbs for lung cancer that you've come across. He says he's too scared to go in the air. That's okay, Bill. We'll ask for you.
Well, cancer is a very difficult disease for the ethnobotanist, because especially in internal cancers. You know, if I'm sent to look for stomach cancer, what do? I ask them if their stomach hurts? I mean, it might be stomach cancer, it might be gas. So this is something very difficult for us to find. On the other hand, skin cancers are a lot more identifiable. And I was just listening to an interview today with a fellow from North Carolina State University who said that in treating skin cancers today, we're using five plants that were used by the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Greeks to treat skin cancer, which just goes to show you these people have figured things out that we're still using. But in terms of lung cancer, I'm afraid I can't help out with anything that, because it's not something I've been sent to look for.
Got it. Another caller from KGA Spokane wants to know, what's your opinion of psychic surgeons? Are there anything similar to what goes on in the Philippines among the shamans that you know in the Amazon?
The Filipinos are the experts at psychic surgery. Psychic surgery is something I cannot explain, but I can accept the fact that it does seem to help some people with some things. But I know of no psychic surgery in the Amazon. The closest parallel would be, as I mentioned at the top of the program, that these shamans claim that diseases are caused by evil spirits from the outside, and sometimes they will seem to pull something from the wound, which represents the evil spirit.
I just wanted to mention, Bill, good luck with the cancer that you have, and there's plenty of alternative methods and a lot of research, so check them all out as well, and many that can be incorporated with a standard therapy. And where are you going exactly in June?
Well, I'm starting in Costa Rica, and I'm running a botany course there, and then I'm off to South America after that.
And another student, this is interesting, calling in from Boise, Idaho. She wants to know, what courses would she take? She's going to college next year, she says. What courses would she take to prep to be an ethnobotanist?
The basic training for ethnobotany is basic botany and basic anthropology. The best places to study ethnobotany in this country are Washington University in St. Louis with my friend Walter Lewis, and then Miami University of Ohio with my colleague Hardy Eschbaugh. Those are the only two places I can think of that have real degrees in ethnobotany.
So there's only a handful of your type around, aren't there?
There aren't really very many, Laura Lee, and that's one of the reasons I wrote Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, to get people interested in the subject, to be able to give them more information in an enjoyable fashion, to say this is important, these shamans are out there, they're dying out, we need to study them, we need to take that information and put it into practice as a complement to Western medicine.
And of all the knowledge that a shaman that you've become close with over the years, have they been able to impart a fraction of what they know to you? A language barrier, the trust element, time is running out. How much do you feel like you are able and other ethnobotanists to gather of that wisdom, of that knowledge, of that history, that legacy?
I've been working with some of these shamans for 14 years. I mean, I've grown up with them. I mean, they regard me as a son or a nephew in some instances. But you hit the nail on the head, which is that I'm just collecting a fraction of what's out there in terms of not only the medicinal knowledge, but the ethnomusic, the philosophy. And that's why I launched the Shaman's Apprentice Program, to get the young people in the tribe interested in the old ways so that the knowledge is passed on within the culture. Because let's face it, they're never going to teach us everything. And it's more important that it be preserved within the culture, so that if they want to teach it to us, and sometimes they will and sometimes they won't, the knowledge exists. Because if they don't pass it on within their culture, that option is completely foreclosed.
I would assume that quantum physics and the shamanistic philosophy would have some parallels.
Well, there's a fellow by the name of Wolf, who's a top physicist, who wrote a book on shamanism and quantum physics.
Fred Allen Wolf.
Been very, very highly recommended, and I've read excerpts of it. It seems to be very good.
We have Dave next calling in. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Laura Lee.
Thanks for asking your own question, by the way. Go ahead.
Mark, I'd like to ask you about, well, I'm a little upset tonight. I had a friend call me and who just became diagnosed as HIV positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From what I've been reading is that traditional medicines really don't have a clue to helping people.
Right. Well, keep in mind, I'm not a physician, but what I emphasize to people who have life-threatening diseases is try Western medicine. If it doesn't work for you, try other things as a complement. Don't start out by thinking that Western medicine knows nothing. Western medicine knows a lot, but don't think that Western medicine is the be-all and end-all. I wish I had something up my sleeve for people with cancer or other diseases that are incurable by Western medicine. I don't. But, you know, there's a lot of ways to heal. There's a lot of ways to cure. Western medicine does not have all the answers, and you have to find out what works for you.
And good luck to you and your friend, Dave. There is a report that when someone is under open brain surgery and you artificially stimulate a certain sector of the brain, they report seeing little green men or little men as on their own inner visual frame. And you were mentioning that when you were offered and you had to take, because of protocol, a certain snuff that was a hallucinogen, you saw little men in the forest, these little aids for the shaman. Is it possible that a hallucinogen could stimulate a portion of the brain? To me, that you can walk into another doorway of another dimension is perfectly fine, but that the brain could be stimulated to allow access could be one way that you take a certain hallucinogenic plant or chemical, or you meditate, you do something to induce an altered state, would be just one more doorway to the same place. So right. I don't discount it and say it's only a mechanical stimulation that produces it, but it seems to me there must be many ways to get there.
Well, Professor Schulte says that one of the great tragedies of the 60s with the whole sensationalization of the drug culture was that it did a lot of damage to serious research, in that these hallucinogens are a type of psychological scalpel. It allows us to investigate the brain in ways that we can't do because we don't have a human experimentation. You can't be chopping around in somebody's brain just to see what the effects are.
Right.
So what these hallucinogens allow us to do is that in a relatively non-intrusive, non-harmful way, if done carefully. But because there was so much of sensationalism, and because there's been such a backlash against it, that this type of psychological research has been set back 30 years.
I understand that even those, when they were able, researchers able to use LSD in a therapeutic way, they had some amazing recoveries. Not to advocate the use, as you explain it. These are something that has to be done with discipline and protocol and information, or you're going to get in real big trouble. But we're out of time. I want to thank you once again, Mark. Mark, happy trails.
Thanks, Laura Lee.
I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com